I don't know why I'm telling you this.
He was investigating the first order decomposition of nitrogen pentoxide, I said. It was work that led eventually to the development of the atomic bomb. There are some letters among his papers from Professor Arrhenius of Stockholm that make it quite clear what they were onto.
And you, as it were, are left to carry the torch.
I beg your pardon?
To carry on the glorious name of Deluce, she said, wherever it may lead you.
This was an interesting thought. It had never occurred to me that one's name could be a compass. And where might that be? I asked, somewhat slyly.
You must listen to your inspiration. You must let your inner vision be your pole star.
I try, I said.
I must sound to Aunt Felicity like the village idiot. I know you do, dear. I've heard several reports of your doings. For instance, there was that horrid business with Bunpenny, or whatever his name was.
Bonepenny, I said. Horace, he died just over there.
I pointed across the lake to the wall of the kitchen garden. Aunt Felicity ploughed on regardless. You must never be deflected by unpleasantness. I want you to remember that. Although it may not be apparent to others, your duty will become as clear to you as if it were a white line painted down the middle of the road. You must follow it, Flavia.
Even when it leads to murder? I asked, suddenly bold.
With her brush extended to arm's length, she painted in the dark shadow of a tree. Even when it leads to murder.
We sat for a few moments in silence, Aunt Felicity dabbing away at her canvas with no particularly exciting results, and then she spoke again.
If you remember nothing else, remember this. Inspiration from outside oneself is like the heat in an oven. It makes passable bath buns. But inspiration from within is like a volcano. It changes the face of the world.
I wanted to throw my arms around this dotty old bat in her George Bernard Shaw costume and hug her until the juices ran out. But I didn't. I couldn't. I was a Deluce. Thank you, Aunt Felicity, I said, scrambling to my feet. You're a brick. Chapter 17. We were at tea in the library. Mrs. Mallet had come in and gone out, leaving behind a vast tray of Jenny Lind cake and currant scones. To my whispered question about Nia, she had replied with a shrug and wrinkled her brow to remind me that she was on duty. Feely was at the piano. It hadn't taken more than 3 minutes for Dieter to ask politely which of us played, and Feely had replied with her blushes. Now, sufficiently coaxed and implored, she was just beginning the second movement of Beethoven's Pathetique Sonata. It was a lovely piece, and as the music faded away and then welled up again, like longings in the heart, I remembered that it was the music Laurie Lawrence had played in Little Women, as Joe, who had refused his proposal, walked away outside his window, and I wondered if Feely had chosen it subconsciously. Father was dreamily tapping a forefinger against the edge of his saucer, which he held beautifully balanced in his hands. There were times when, for no apparent reason, I felt a huge tidal wave of love, or at least respect for him, and this was one of them. In the corner, Taffy was curled up like a cat in an armchair, still in the clutches of The Anatomy of Melancholy, and Aunt Felicity sat contentedly near the window, doing something intricate with a pair of needles and a ball of sulphur yellow wool. Suddenly I noticed that Dieter was biting the corner of his lip, and there was a glistening at the corner of his eye. He was almost in tears and trying not to show it. How cruel it was of that witch, Feely, to choose something so sad and so evocative, a melody by Beethoven that could only serve as a bitter reminder to our German guest of the homeland he had left behind. But at that instant, Feely broke off abruptly and leapt up from the keyboard. Oh, she gasped. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to.
And I could see that for probably the first time in her life, she was genuinely distressed.
She flew to Dieter's side and held out her handkerchief, and to his eternal credit, he took it.
"No, it is I who should be sorry," he said, wiping at his eyes. "It's just that..."
"Dieter," I found my mouth suddenly blurting, "tell us how you came to be a prisoner of war. I've been simply dying to ask you. I'm frightfully keen on history, you know. You could have heard a pin drop in Antarctica."
"Flavia,"
Father finally managed, but only when it was far too late to have the effect that he intended. But Dieter was already smiling. It seemed to me he was relieved to have got past the dampness.
"But of course," he said. "For 5 years I have been waiting for someone to ask me, but no one ever has. You English are all such perfect gentlemen, even the ladies."
Aunt Felicity shot him a look of beaming approval.
"But," Dieter added, "I must warn you, it's a long story. Are you sure you want to hear it?"
Daffy closed her book and set it aside.
"I adore long stories," she said. "In fact, the longer, the better."
Dieter took up a stance on the rug in front of the fireplace, his elbow on the mantelpiece. You could almost picture him at a hunting lodge in the Black Forest.
"Though," he said, "I think you should safely say that I was shot down in England because of the Bronte sisters."
"Shot down? This was something new. I was all agog."
Daffy's eyes were instantly like china doorknobs, and even Father sat up straight.
"Good Lord," he muttered.
"I was spoiled as a boy," Dieter began, "and I must admit to it. I was an only child, brought up in a well-to-do household by a Kinder Flegrin, a nursery governess. My father, as I have said, was a publisher, and my mother an archaeologist. Although they loved me well enough, I suppose, they were both so wrapped up in their own worlds that everything having to do with the boy was left up to Drusilla." That was the governess's name, Drusilla. Drusilla was a very great reader of English novels. She consumed books like a whale eats krill. You never saw her without a book in her hand. In fact, she taught me to read while I was still sucking my thumb. Drusilla had read all of the Bronte sisters' books, of course. Futhering Heights, Jane Eyre, Shirley, The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. She had them almost by heart. I was half in love with her, I think, and I thought that I could make her love me by reading aloud in English from her favorites. And that was how I became an Anglophile. From that time on, I wanted nothing more than to read English books. Dickens, of course, and Conan Doyle, Jane Austen and Thomas Hardy. When I was a bit older, Drusilla gave me for Christmas subscriptions to The Boy's Own Annual and Chums. By the time I was 12, I was more British than many a boy from Brixton. Then came the wireless. From the articles in Chums, and with the help of a schoolboy friend who lived next door, his name was Wolfgang Zander, I was able to put together a simple single-valve wireless receiver which we could tune into the broadcasts of the BBC. We were mad about electrical gadgets, Wolfgang and I. The first thing we made was a battery-operated doorbell. The next was a telephone between my bedroom and his, with the wire strung over the rooftops and through the trees. Long after our families were asleep, that cotton-covered wire high in the branches buzzed long into the night with our feverish speculations. We would talk away the night about wireless, of course, but also about English books, for Wolfgang, you see, also had been bitten by the English, and particularly the Bronte bug. The adolescent imagination is a powerful force, and I suppose we saw ourselves, Wolfgang and I, as knights of the Round Table who would come riding out from our Teutonic stronghold to rescue these Bronte sisters, these three fair, pale maidens, whose very names identify them as daughters of the Thunder God, who were being held hostage by a monster in their cold stone tower in the north. Besides, he added,
There is something about young, helpless damsels in damp climates that makes every adolescent boy want to carry them off and marry them.
He paused to let his words have their effect, looking keenly from one of us to another, and as he did, I saw with a sudden shock that in Feely and Daffy and me, Dieter fancied he had found his Brontes, and in Buckshaw his cold stone tower. We were his Charlotte, Emily and Anne. And there we sat, the three of us, our mouths hanging open like dogs. My mind was reeling as Dieter went on.
"But too soon we grow up," he said with a sigh. "Too soon we take on the joys of the grown-up world, but also its troubles. Always there's an age when boys discover flying, and it came early to me. My parents enrolled me in the NSFK, the National Socialist Flying Corps. And when I was 14, I found myself suddenly alone at the controls of a Schulgleiter, soaring like a hawk high above the Wasserkuppe in the hills of the Hessian Rhone. From the air, these mountains, even though they are of quite a different geology, bear in some places a startling resemblance to the moors of North Yorkshire."
"How do you know that?"
Daffy interrupted.
"Daphne," Father said, his pointed look added the word manners.
"Is it because you've bombed Sheffield?"
There was a shocked silence at her question.
How bold she was! Even I would not have asked Dieter about his aerial activities over England, although I will admit that, just minutes before, that very point had crossed my mind.
"Because," Daffy added, "if you have, you must say so."
"I was coming to that," Dieter said quietly.
He continued without batting an eye.
"When the war came and I was transferred to the Luftwaffe, I always kept a small English everyman editions of Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights wrapped carefully in a white silk flying scarf at the bottom of my rucksack, cheek to cheek with Lord Byron and Shelley. I decided that when the war was over, I would enroll at a university, perhaps even Oxford, since I already had the language, where I would read English literature. I would take a double first and accept a teaching post at one of the great public schools and would end my days as an honored and respected schoolmaster, somewhat like your Mr. Chips. Goodbye, Herr Schranz, I used to say, but fate had not yet finished with me. An order was received that I was to proceed at once to France. My father, it seemed, had run into an old acquaintance in Berlin, someone who was high up in the ministry and could arrange almost anything one might desire. Father wanted to have a son who flew a fighter, one whose name was in all the headlines, not one who mooned about with his nose in a book, and an English book at that. Before I could protest, I found myself posted to a reconnaissance group, Luftflotte 3, based in France near Lille. Our aircraft was the Messerschmitt Bf 110, a twin-engine machine nicknamed the Zerstörer.
"The destroyer," said Daffy sourly. "There were times when she could be quite snappish."
"Yes," Dieter replied. "The destroyer. This one, though, was specially modified for reconnaissance duties. We carried no bombs."
"Spying,"
Daffy said. Her cheeks were a little flushed, though whether from anger or excitement, I could not tell.
"Yes, spying, if you like," Dieter agreed. "In the war, there was reconnaissance on both sides."
"He's right, you know, Daphne," Father said. "As I was saying," Dieter went on with a glance at Daffy, "the Zerstörer was a twin-engine machine with a crew of two, a pilot and a second member who could be a wireless operator, a navigator, or a rear gunner, depending upon the mission. My first day on the line, as I walked towards the briefing hut, an Oberfeldwebel, a flight sergeant in flying boots, clicked his heels and called out, 'Herr Hauptmann Heathcliff!' Of course, it was my old chum, Wolfgang Zander. I looked around quickly to see if anyone had heard him, since such familiarity between ranks would not be tolerated.
but no one else was within earshot. We shook hands happily.
I'm your navigator, Wolfgang said, laughing. Did they tell you that? Of all the navigators in the land, my name alone was chosen to be carried aloft to the wars in your tin dragon.
Although it was wonderful to see him again, we had to be discreet. It was a complicated situation. We developed a whole set of stratagems, rather like lovers in a Regency romance. We would walk to the aircraft, pointing here and there with our fingers and ducking under the fuselage as if we were discussing the tension of cables. But our talk, of course, was of little but English novels. If anyone came close, we would switch quickly from Hardy to Hitler. It was during one of these inspections that the great scheme was born. I don't remember now if it was Wolfgang or I who first came up with the idea. We were walking around Kathy's tail. Kathy was the thinly disguised name painted on the nose of our aircraft, when suddenly one of us, I think it might have been Wolfgang, or it might have been me, said, "Do you suppose the heather is in bloom today on Howarth Moor?" It was that simple. In just those few moments, the die, as Julius Caesar remarked, was cast. And then, as if she had been listening at the door, fate again stepped in. 2 days later, we were given an objective in South Yorkshire. A railway yard and a bicycle factory sought to be producing Rolls-Royce engines. Photographs only, a piece of cake, as the RAF blogs used to say. A perfect opportunity to deliver, in person, our little gift. The flight across the channel was uneventful, and for once, we were not bounced by Spitfires. The weather was beautiful, and Cassie's engines were purring away like a pair of huge, contented cats. We arrived over the target on time, on the dot, as you say, and took our photographs. Snap, 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 and we were finished. Mission accomplished. The next quarter of an hour belonged to us. The parsonage at Howarth now lay less than 10 miles to the northwest, and at our speed, which was 300 miles an hour, it was no more than 2 minutes away. The problem was that we were too high. Although we had descended to 17,000 feet for the photographs for our personal mission, we needed to lose more altitude quickly. A Messerschmitt with black crosses on its wings, swooping down like a hawk upon a quiet English village, would hardly go unnoticed. I shoved the control column forward, and down we circled in a giant spiral, our ears popping like champagne corks. Beneath us, the heather on the moor was a sea of purple billows. At 1,000 feet, I began to pull out and dropped nearly to hedge level. "Get ready," I shouted to Wolfgang. We came in from the east, and suddenly there it was atop its hill, the village of Howarth. We roared along, skimming the fields, barely clearing the farmhouse chimney pots. As we came in over the Howarth Road, I caught my first glimpse of the church at the top of the steep, high street. Then, 100 yards behind it, beyond the churchyard, the familiar shape of the Brontes parsonage. It was exactly as I had always imagined it. The dark, stained stones and the empty windows. "Now," I shouted, and Wolfgang shoved our gift out the open ports in the canopy and into the slipstream. Although I couldn't see it, I could picture our wreath arcing down through the air, tumbling over and over, its purple ribbon streaming out behind it as it fell. Later, someone would retrieve it from among the old tombstones near the parsonage door and read the message, gold letters the colour of gorse on heather-coloured silk, saying, "All the world loves you. Rest in peace." It was too risky to climb back to cruising altitude. We should have to go home by hedgehopping from point to point, keeping to the open countryside. Of course, we would burn more fuel that way, but both of us were young and foolish, and we had done what we had come to do.
As soon as we were spotted, we knew all the hounds of hell, the hurricanes and spitfires, would be on our tail. But it was a perfect August day. With a bit of luck and a tailwind, I was telling Wolfgang, we might even manage to overfly Thomas Hardy's house on the way home at no additional cost to the Reich. It was at that precise moment that the canopy in front of my face shattered in a rain of exploding bullets. We were hit. "Spitfire!" Wolfgang shouted. But it was too late. A dark shadow shot past us, then banked and turned, its red, white, and blue randals flashing like mad eyes in the summer sun. "Watch out!" I yelled. "He's coming round for another pass!" It was then that I noticed that our port engine temperature gauge was pinned to the top. It was overheating. I glanced to the side and, to my horror, saw the black smoke and orange flames that were billowing out from beneath the cowling. I feathered the prop and switched off the engine. By now, the Spitfire was behind us again. In what was left of my rearview mirror, I could see his fragmented image rocking gently from side to side, riding our slipstream. He had us in his sights. But he held his fire. It was most unnerving. "Come on, I thought. Get it over, Viz. He was playing with us like a terrier with a rat." I don't know how long it went on. You cannot judge time when you are about to die. "Why doesn't he shoot?" I called out to Wolfgang, but there was no answer. With my shoulder harness locked, I could not twist around far enough in my seat to see him. But even on one engine, Cassie was easily able to stay aloft, and for what seemed like an eternity, that British hound chased the German hare across the green countryside. The shattered windscreen had reduced forward visibility to zero, and I had to tack sharply from side to side in order to see what lay ahead. It was a dicey situation. And then the other engine died. Foot. Just like that. I had only seconds to make a decision. The trees on a wooded hill were rushing by beneath the wings. At the edge of the wood was a sloping field. It was there that I would put her down. No wheels, I thought. Better to make a belly landing and come to a stop more quickly. The sound of the crash was louder than I ever could have imagined. The aircraft slewed from side to side as the earth tore at her belly, battering and banging along, lurching, bucking. It was like being thrown alive into a mill race. And then, the unearthly silence. It took a moment to realize that we were no longer moving. I unbuckled my harness, threw back the front canopy, and jumped out onto the wing, then ran back and peered in at Wolfgang. "Get out!" I shouted. "Quickly, get out!" But there was no reply. Inside the glass canopy, in a sea of blood, Wolfgang sat with a happy smile on his face. His dead eyes were staring out almost feverishly at the green English countryside. I jumped down from the wing and vomited into the long grass. We had come to rest at the far side of the field. Now, from higher up on the hillside, two men, one tall, the other short, had emerged from the trees and were clumping slowly, warily down towards me. One of them was carrying a shotgun, the other a pitchfork. I stood there, not moving. As they drew near, I put one hand in the air, slowly pulled my pistol from its holster, and threw it away, making sure they saw what I was doing. Then I put up the other hand. "You're a German," the tall man called out as they approached. "Yes," I shouted back, "but I speak English." He seemed a little taken aback. "Perhaps you should call the police," I suggested, jerking my head towards the battered Messerschmitt. "My friend is dead in there." The tall man edged cautiously over to the aircraft and peered inside. The other stood his ground, staring at me as if I had landed from another planet. He drew the pitchfork back as if he were about to jab me in the stomach.
"Let him be, Rupert," the man with the shotgun said. "He's just had a bad crash."
Before the other man could respond, there was a high-pitched screaming in the sky, and the Spitfire shot past, lifting at the end of the field into a victory roll. I watched it climb straight up into the blue air, and then I said, "He rises and begins to round. He drops the silver chain of sound." The two men looked at me as if I had suddenly fallen into shock, and perhaps I had. Not until later would it come crashing home to me that poor Wolfgang was dead. "George Meredith," I told them, "the lark ascending." Later, at the police station in the village, the Spitfire pilot paid me a visit. He was with a squadron based at Catterick and had taken his machine up to check the controls after the mechanics had made a few adjustments. He had not the slightest intention of getting into a scrap that day, he told me, but there we were, Wolfgang and I, suddenly in his gun sights over Haworth. What else could he do? "Hell of a prank, bad luck, old chap," he said. "Damn sorry about your friend." "All of that for 6 years ago," Dieter said with a sigh. The tall man in the field with the shotgun, as I was to find out later, was Gordon Ingleby. The other one, the man with the pitchfork, as perhaps you have already guessed, was Rupert Pawson.
Chapter 18.
Rupert Pawson? But how could the man with the pitchfork have been Rupert? My mind was spinning like a painted tin top. The last place on earth I had ever expected Dieter's tale to end was in Jubilee Field at the Ingleby Farm. But one thing now became perfectly clear. If Rupert had been at Culverhouse Farm 6 years ago, during the war, it would explain, at least in part, how the wooden face of his puppet Jack had come to be carved in the image of Robin Ingleby. Father let out a sigh.
"I remember it well," he said. "Your machine was brought down in Jubilee Field, just below Gibbet Wood."
Dieter nodded. "I was sent for a short time to a prisoner of war camp with 30 or 40 other Luftwaffe officers and men, where our days were spent ditching and hedging. It was back-breaking work, but at least I was still in England. Most German pilots who were captured were sent abroad to camps in Canada, where there was little hope of escape. When I was offered a chance to live and work on a farm, I jumped at it. Although it was not compulsory, many of us did. Those who did not called us traitors, among other things. But the war was moving towards its end, and a lot of us knew it. Better to begin paving my own personal road to Oxford, I thought, than to leave my future to chance. No one was more surprised than I was to find I had been assigned to the Ingleby's farm. It amused me to think that Gordon, who only a short time before had had me at the end of a shotgun, was now helping Grace fry my kippers in the farmhouse kitchen.
That was 6 years ago, you say, in 1944, I asked.
It was, Dieter nodded.
In September. I couldn't help it. Before I could stifle the words, I found myself blurting. Then you must have been at Culverhouse Farm when Robin was found hanging in Gibbet Wood.
Flavia, Father said, putting his cup and saucer down with a clatter.
We will have no gossiping about the grief of others.
Dieter's face went suddenly grim, and a fire, could it have been anger, came into his eyes.
It was I, he said, who found him.
You who found him, I thought. Impossible! Mrs. Mullet had made it perfectly clear that it was Mad Meg who had discovered Robin's body.
There was a remarkably long silence, and then Feely leapt to her feet to refresh Dieter's teacup.
"You must excuse my little sister," she said with a brittle laugh. "She has rather an unhealthy fascination with death."
Full points, Feely, I thought. But although she had hit the nail on the head, she didn't know the half of it. The rest of the afternoon was pretty much a thud. Father had made what I admit was a noble attempt to switch the conversation to the weather and the flax crops, while Daffy, sensing that little else was worthy of her attention, had crawled back into her book. One by one, we made our excuses. Father to tend to his stamps, Aunt Felicity to have a nap before supper, and Daffy to the library. After a while, I grew bored with listening to Feely prattle on to Dieter about various balls and outings in the country, and made my escape to the laboratory. I chewed on the end of my pencil for a while, and then I wrote. Sunday, 23rd of July, 1950. Where is everyone? That is the burning question. Where is Nia? After spending the night at Mrs. Mullet's cottage, she simply disappears. Does Inspector Hewitt know she's gone? Where is Mad Meg? After erupting at the afternoon performance of Jack and the Beanstalk, she is taken to rest on the vicar's couch. And then she vanishes. Where is Mutt Wilmot? He seems to have slunk off sometime during the fatal performance. What was Rupert doing at Culverhouse Farm 6 years ago? Why, when he and Dieter met at the farm on Friday, did they not admit that they already knew one another? And why, above all, does Dieter claim to be the one who found Robin Ingleby's body hanging in Chibbett Wood? Mrs. Mullet says it was Mad Meg, and Mrs. M is seldom wrong when it comes to village chin-wagging. Yet why would Dieter lie about a thing like that? Where to begin? If this were a chemical experiment, the procedure would be obvious. I would start with those materials most closely to hand. Mrs. Mullet! With any luck, she would still be puttering in the kitchen before plundering the pantry and carting off her daily booty to Alf. I ran to the top of the stairs and peered through the balustrades. Nobody in the hall. I slid down the banister and dashed into the kitchen. Dogger looked up from the table where, with clinical accuracy, he was excising the skin from a couple of cucumbers. "She's gone," he said, before I could ask. "A good half hour ago." "He's a devil, that Dogger. I don't know how he does it. Did she say anything before she left? Anything interesting, that is?" With Dogger in the kitchen as an audience, Mrs. M would hardly have been able to resist blathering on about how she took Nia in, poor waif, tucked her into a cosy bed with a hot water bottle and a glass of watered-down sherry, and so forth, with a full account of how she slept, what they had had for breakfast, and what she left on her plate. "No." Dogger picked up a serrated bread knife and applied its edge to a loaf of new bread. "Just that the joint is in the warming oven, apple pie and clotted cream in the pantry."
"Bugger!"
Well then, there was nothing for it but to make a fresh start in the morning. I'd set my alarm for sunrise, then strike out for Culverhouse Farm and Chibbett Wood beyond. It was unlikely that there would be any clues left after all these years, but Rupert and Nia had camped at the bottom of Jubilee Field on Friday night. If my plan were properly executed, I could be there and back before anyone at Buckshaw even knew that I was gone. Dogger tore off a perfect square of waxed paper and wrapped the cucumber sandwiches with hospital bed corners. "I thought I'd make these tonight," he said, handing me the package. "I knew you'd want to get away early in the morning." Curtains of wet mist hung in the fields. The morning air was damp and chill, and I breathed in deeply, trying to come fully awake, filling my nostrils and then my lungs with the rich aroma of dark soil and sodden grass. As I bicycled into St. Tancred's churchyard, I saw that the inspector's Vauxhall was gone, and so, I reasoned, was Rupert's body. Not that they would have left him crumpled on the puppet stage from Saturday evening until Monday morning, but I realized that the corpse would no longer be there inside the parish hall, its eyes bugging, its string of saliva congealed by now into a stalactite of spit. If I thought it had been, I might have been tempted to barge in for another look. Beyond the church, I removed my shoes and socks and wheeled Gladys through the deeper water beside the submerged stepping stones. Saturday night's rain had increased the flow of water, which roiled about her spokes and tires, washing clean the accumulated mud and clay from my ride into Bishop's Lacey. By the time I reached the other bank, Gladys's livery was as fresh as a lady's painted carriage. I gave my feet a final rinse, sat down on a stile, and restored my footwear. Here, along the river, visibility was even less than it had been on the road. Trees and hedges loomed like pale shadows as I cycled along the grassy verge in a grey, woolly fog that blotted all the sound and colour from the world. Except for the muted grumble of the water, all was silence. At the bottom of Jubilee Field, Rupert's van stood forlorn beneath the willows, its gaily painted sign, Pawson's Puppets, jarringly out of place with both the location and the circumstances. There wasn't a sign of life. I laid Gladys carefully down in the grass and tiptoed alongside the van. Perhaps Nia had crept back and was now asleep inside, and I wouldn't want to frighten her. But the lack of condensation on the windscreen told me what I had already begun to feel, that no one was breathing inside the cold Austin. I peered in at the windows but saw nothing unusual. I went round to the back door and gave the handle a twist. It was locked. I walked in ever-widening circles through the grass, looking for any trace of a fire, but there was none. The campsite was as I had left it on Saturday. As I reached the bottom of the farm lane, I was stopped in my tracks by a rope hung across the road, from which a sign was suspended. I ducked underneath to read its message. Police investigation. No admittance by order. Hindley Constabulary. Inspector Hewitt and his detectives had been here. But in posting their sign, they had obviously not thought of anyone coming across the swollen river. In spite of his promise to the inspector, Sergeant Graves had still not learned his lesson about people slipping in by way of the back door. Very well, then. Since there was nothing to see here anyway, I would move on to my next objective. Although I could not see it in the fog, I knew that Gibbet Wood lay not far ahead at the top of Gibbet Hill. It would be wet and soggy in among the trees, but I was willing to bet that the police had not been there before me. I dragged Gladys under the barricade and pushed her slowly up the lane, which was far too steep to pedal. Halfway to the top, I shoved her behind a hawthorn hedge and continued my climb, hemmed in on all sides with misty glimpses of blue flax. Then suddenly, the dark trees of the wood loomed out of the mist immediately in front of me. I had come upon it without realizing how close I was. A weathered wooden sign was nailed to a tree, bearing the red words, "Keep out, Tresp." The rest of it had been shot away by poachers. As I had known it would be, everything in the wood was wet. I gave a shiver at the clammy coldness, steeled myself, and waded into the vegetation. Before I had gone half a dozen steps into the ferns and bracken, I was thoroughly soaked to the knees. Something snapped in the underbrush. I froze as a dark form swooped on silent wings across my path. An owl, perhaps, mistaking the heavy morning mist for its twilight hunting time. Although it had startled me, its very presence was comforting. It meant that no one else was with me in the wood. I pushed on, trying to follow the faint paths, any one of which, I knew, would lead me to the clearing at the very center. Between two ancient gnarled trees, the way was barred with what seemed to be a mossy gate, its grey wood twisted with rot. I was halfway over the crumbling barrier before I realized that I was once again at the steps of the old gallows. how many doomed souls had climbed these very stairs before being turned off the platform overhead. With a gulp, I looked up at the remnants of the structure, which now was open to the sky. A leathery hand seized my wrist like a band of hot iron.
"What are you up to, then? What are you doing snooping round this place?"
It was Mad Meg. She shoved her sooty face so close to mine I could see the sandy bristles on the end of her chin. The witch in the wood, I thought, for one panicky moment, before I regained my senses.
"Oh, hello, Meg,"
I said, as calmly as I could, trying to tame my pounding heart.
"I'm glad I found you. You gave me quite a fright."
My voice was shakier than I had hoped.
"Frights as lives in Gibbet Wood," Meg said darkly. "Frights as live here and not elsewhere."
"Exactly," I agreed, not having the faintest idea what she was on about.
"I'm glad you're here with me. Now I shan't be afraid."
"No devil now," Meg said, rubbing her hands together. "Devil's dead and jolly good."
I remembered how frightened she had been at Rupert's performance of Jack and the Beanstalk. To Meg, Rupert was the devil who had killed Robin Ingleby, shrunk him to a wooden doll, and put him on the stage. Better to approach this indirectly.
"Did you have a nice rest at the vicarage, Meg?"
I asked. She spat on the trunk of an oak as if she was spitting in a rival witch's eye.
"Her turned me out," she said. "Took old Meg's bracelet and turned her out, so she did. Dirty, dirty."
"Mrs. Richardson," I asked, "the vicar's wife, she turned you out?" Meg grinned a horrid grin and set off through the trees at a near gallop. I followed at her heels through underbrush and ferns, deadfall in the snags of thorns. 5 minutes later and breathless, we were back where we had begun, at the foot of the rotted gallows.
"See there," she said, pointing. "That's where he took him."
"Took who, Meg?"
"Robin Ingleby, she meant. I was sure of it."
"The devil took Robin right here?" I asked.
"Turned him into wood, he did," she confided, looking over her shoulder. "Wood to wood."
"Did you actually see him? The devil, I mean."
This was something that hadn't occurred to me before. Was there a chance that Meg had seen someone in the wood with Robin? She lived, after all, in a shack among the trees, and it seemed unlikely that much happened within the bounds of Gibbet Wood that escaped her scrutiny.
"Meg saw," she said knowingly.
"What did he look like?"
"Meg saw. Old Meg sees plenty."
"Can you draw?" I asked, with sudden inspiration.
I pulled my notebook from my pocket and handed her a stubby pencil.
"Here," I said, flipping to a blank page. "Draw me the devil. Draw him in Gibbet Wood. Draw the devil taking Robin."
Meg gave something that I can describe only as a wet snicker. And then she squatted down, flattened the open notebook against her knee, and began to draw. I think I was expecting something childish, nothing more than scrawled stick figures. But in Meg's sooty fingers, the pencil sprang to life. On the page, the glade in Gibbet Wood slowly appeared. A tree here, a tree there. Now the rotted wood of the gallows, instantly recognizable. She had started at the margins and was working in towards the center of the page. From time to time, she clucked over her work, turning the pencil over and erasing a line. She was quite good, I have to give her that. Her sketch was probably better than I might have done myself. And then she drew Robin. I scarcely dared breathe as I looked on over her shoulder. Little by little, the dead boy took shape before my eyes. He was hanging quite peacefully in midair, his neck canted to one side, a look of slightly surprised contentment on his face, as if he had suddenly and unexpectedly
walked into a room full of angels. In spite of the subdued light of the wood, his neatly parted hair gave off a healthy and therefore rather unnerving shine. He wore a striped sweater and dark breeches, their legs tucked carelessly into a pair of rubber boots. He must have died quickly, I thought. Only then did she draw the noose that cramped his neck, a dark braided thing that dangled from the gallows into the space beneath. She shaded the rope with angry slashes of the pencil. I breathed in deeply. Meg looked up at me triumphantly, seeking approval.
"And now the devil," I whispered. "Draw the devil, Meg."
She looked me straight in the eye, relishing the attention. A canny smile appeared at the corner of her mouth.
"Please, Meg, draw the devil."
Without taking her eyes from mine, she licked a finger and thumb and turned elaborately to a fresh page. She began again, and as she drew, gibbet wood appeared once more at her fingertips. This second sketch grew darker than the first as Meg scrubbed at the pencil marks, smearing them to suggest the half-light of the glade. Then came the gallows, viewed this time from a slightly different angle. How odd, I thought, that she didn't begin with the devil, as most people would be tempted to do. But only when she had set the stage to her own satisfaction, with trees and bushes, did she begin to roughen the figure that was to be the focus of her creation. In an approximate oval that she had left blank upon the page until now, a sketchy figure began to emerge. Arms and shoulders first, followed by knees, legs, arms, hands, and feet. It wore a black jacket and stood on one leg in the clearing, as if captured in the midst of a frenzied dance. Its trousers were hung by their suspenders from a low-hanging branch. Meg shielded the paper with her left hand as she penciled in the features. When she was finished, she thrust it at me roughly, as if the paper were contaminated. It took me a moment to recognize the face, to recognize that the figure in the glade, the devil, was the vicar, Denwin Richardson. The vicar? It was too ridiculous for words. Or was it? Just minutes earlier, Meg had told me the devil was dead, and now she was sketching him as a vicar. What was going on in her poor, addled mind?
"Are you quite sure, Meg?" I asked, tapping the notebook. "Is that the devil?"
"Psst," she said, cocking her head and putting her fingers to my lips.
"Someone's coming."
I looked round the glade, which, even to my heightened sense of hearing, seemed perfectly silent. When I looked back, my notebook and pencil lay at my feet, and Meg had vanished among the trees. I knew there was little point in calling her back. I stood there motionless for a few moments, listening, waiting for something, although I'm not sure what it was. The woodland, I remembered, is an ever-changing world. From minute to minute, the shadows shift, and from hour to hour, the vegetation moves with the sun. Insects tunnel in the soil, heaving it up, at first in little hummocks, and then in larger ones. From month to month, leaves grow and fall, and from year to year, the trees. Daffy once said that you can't step into the same river twice, and it's the same with forests. 5 winters had come and gone since Robin Ingleby died here, and now there was nothing left to see. I walked slowly back past the crumbling gallows and plunged into the woods. Within minutes, I was out into the open at the top of Jubilee Field. Not 20 yards away, almost invisible in the fog, a grey Ferguson tractor was stopped in the field, and someone in a green overall and rubber boots was bending over the engine. That must have been what Meg had heard. "Hello," I shouted. It's always best to announce oneself heartily when trespassing. Even though I had invented it on the spot, this seemed to be a good general rule. As the figure straightened up and turned round, I realized that it was Sally Straw, the Land Army girl. "Hello,"
she said, wiping her oily hands on a rag.
You're Flavia Deluce, aren't you?
Yes, I stuck out my hand. And you're Sally. I've seen you at the market. I've always admired your freckles and your ginger hair. To be most effective, flattery is always best applied with a trowel. She gave me a broad, honest grin and a handshake that nearly crushed my fingers.
It's all right to call me Sal, she said. All my best friends do.
She reminded me somewhat of Joyce Grenfell, the actress, a bit mannish in the way she moved, but otherwise decidedly female.
My Fergie's gone bust, she said, pointing to the tractor. Might be the ignition coil. They do that sometimes, you know, get overheated and go open circuit. Then there's nothing for it but to wait for the ruddy thing to cool.
Since motors were not my forte, I nodded wisely and kept my mouth shut.
What are you doing away out here?
Just rambling, I said. I like to get away sometimes, go for a walk, that sort of thing.
Lucky you, she said. I never get away. Well, hardly ever. Dieter's taken me for a pint of half and half at the 13 Drakes a couple of times. But then there was a most god-awful flap about it. The POWs are not allowed to do that, you know. At least they weren't during the war. Dieter told me your sister Ophelia had him to tea yesterday, she added somewhat cagily. I realized at once that she was fishing.
Yes, I said, kicking carelessly at a clod of dirt, gazing off into the distance and pretending I wasn't remotely interested.
Friend or not, if she wanted gossip from me, it would have to be tit for tat.
I saw you at the puppet show, I said, at the church on Saturday night.
Wasn't that a corker? About Mr. Pawson, I mean.
It was horrid, she said.
Did you know him? It probably wasn't a fair question, and I fired it at her without warning, straight out of the blue. Sally's expression became instantly guarded, and she hesitated a bit too long before answering. I've seen him around.
Her lie was obvious.
On the telly, perhaps, I asked, perhaps too innocently. The Magic Kingdom? Snoddy the Squirrel?
I knew as soon as I said it that I'd pushed things too far.
All right, she said. What are you up to? Come on, out with it.
She planted her hands on her hips and fixed me with an unwavering stare.
I don't know what you mean, I said. Oh, come off it. Don't give me that. Everyone for 50 miles around knows that Flavia Deluce doesn't go walking in the woods just to put roses in her cheeks.
Could that be true? 50 miles? Her answer rather surprised me.
I should have thought 100.
Gordon, I'd have your hide if he caught you in that wood, she said, pointing to the sign. I put on my best sheepish look but kept quiet.
How much do you know about all this? Sally demanded, sweeping her hand round in a large half circle to take in the farm. Her meaning was clear. I took a deep breath. I had to trust her.
I know that Rupert has been coming here to get cannabis for quite a long time. I know that Gordon grows it in a patch in Gibbet Wood, not far from where Robin was found hanging.
And you think that Dieter and I are somehow mixed up in all this?
I don't know, I replied. I hope not.
So do I, Sally said. So do I.
Chapter 19.
Rupert was a ladies' man, Sally said slowly, as if reluctant to put her thoughts into words. But then, you've probably found that out by now.
I nodded, careful not to interrupt. I had learned by observing Inspector Hewitt that silence is the best primer for a conversational pump.
He's been coming to Culverhouse Farm on and off for years, since well before the war. And Rupert's not the only one, you know. Gordon has a regular little army of others just like him. He supplies them with something to help manage the pain.
Bung, I said. Oh, I couldn't help myself. Ganja, Indian hemp, cannabis.
She looked at me with narrowed eyes and then went on. Some, like Rupert, come because they once had infantile paralysis. Polio, they call it now. Others, well, God only knows.
You see, Gordon considers himself a kind of herbalist, someone who helps to blot out the sufferings that the doctors can't or won't. He's very discreet about it. But then he has to be, doesn't he? Other than you, I really don't think anyone in Bishop's Lacey has ever guessed that the occasional travellers who stop by Culverhouse Farm are anything other than lost, or perhaps selling agricultural supplies. I've been here for 8 years, Sally went on, and don't even bother asking me. The answer is no. I'm not one of Gordon's smokers.
I didn't expect you were,
I said, fawning a little. It worked. I grew up in a good home, she went on, a little more eagerly. My parents were what they used to call, in the old double-decker novels, poor but honest. My mum was sick all the time, but she never would tell us what was wrong with her. Even my father didn't know. Meanwhile, I plodded on at school, got myself a bit of an education, and then the war came. Of course, I wanted to help out a bit with the medical bills, so I joined the WLA. Sounds simple, doesn't it? And so it was. There was no more to it than that. I was just a girl from Kent who wanted to fight Adolf Hitler and see her mother well again. I was billeted, along with about 40 other girls, at a land army hostel between here and Hindley, and that was where I first laid eyes on Rupert. Like a bee to honey, that man was, make no mistake about it. He was rambling hither and yon about the countryside every summer with his little puppet show, getting back to his roots, he called it, and whenever I saw him, he seemed to have a new assistant. And she was always a bit of a knockout, if you get my meaning. Not long after I came to work at Culverhouse Farm, Rupert showed up for a fresh supply of smoking material. I recognized him at once as a little lame chap who was always chatting us up at the hostel, or the pub, of a weekend. I swore from the outset that I wouldn't get involved with him myself. I'd leave it to the other girls to take him down a notch or two. But then... her gaze drifted off into another time. So Nia had been right. Rupert had gone off in search of Sally on the day they arrived. The pieces were beginning to fall into place. Although the fog had now thinned a little, it was still quite dense, wrapping Sally and me in a misty cocoon of oddly reassuring silence. Unless they had come across us by accident, no one would know we were up here at the top of Jubilee Field. No one could have overheard us unless they had come up the length of the field from the bottom or crept stealthily down from the wood above. Oh, Rupert was a charmer. Make no mistake about that, Sally went on. He could charm the... No, I mustn't say that in polite company, must I? He could charm the chickens out of the trees, and especially the hens. He'd start with Shakespeare, and then move on to things he'd heard in music halls. If Romeo and Juliet didn't do the job, he'd try his naughty recitations. And he got away with it too, at least, mostly he did, until he tried it on with Gordon's wife.
Grace Ingleby?
I let out an involuntary whistle. That must have been quite a long time ago, I said. I knew that it sounded callous, although I didn't mean it that way.
Years ago, Sally said, before Robin died, before she went all strange. Although you wouldn't think it to look at her now, she used to be quite a stunner.
She seems very sad, I said.
Sad?
Sad's not the word for it, Flavia. Broken is more like it. That little boy was her whole world, and the day he died, the sun went out.
You were here then? I asked gently. It must have been very difficult for you.
She went on as if she hadn't heard me. Gordon and Grace had told Robin more than once about their idyllic honeymoon by the sea, and it was something he'd always wanted to do. The sand, the seashells, the pail, the shovel, the sand castles, the ices, the bathing machines. He used to dream about it. I dreamed the tide was coming in, Sally, he told me once, and I was bobbing on the sea like a pink balloon. Poor little tyke. She wiped away a tear with the rough sleeve of her overall. God, why am I telling you all this? I must be daft.
It's all right,
I said. I promise I won't breathe a word.
I'm very good at keeping things to myself. As a token of goodwill, I went through the motions of cross my heart and hope to die, but without actually saying the words.
After a quick and oddly shy glance at me, Sally went on with her story. Somehow, they'd managed to put a bit aside for Robin's birthday. Because the harvest was so near, Gordon couldn't get away. But they agreed that Grace would take Robin to the seaside for a few days. It was the first time the two of them, mother and son, had ever been anywhere together without Gordon, and the first time Grace had taken a holiday since she was a girl. The weather was hot, even for late August. Grace hired a beach chair and bought a magazine. She watched Robin with his little pail mudlarking along the water's edge. He was quite safe, she knew. She had warned him about the danger of the tides, and Robin was a most obedient little boy. She drifted off to sleep and slept for ages. She hadn't realized how utterly exhausted she was until she awoke and saw how far the sun had moved. The tide had gone out, and Robin was nowhere in sight. Had he disobeyed her warnings and been swept out to sea? Surely someone would have seen him. Surely someone would have wakened her. "Did Grace tell you this?" I asked. "Good God, no. It all came out at the inquest. They had to pry it out of her in tiny broken pieces. Her nerves were something shocking. She'd wasted too much time, she said, running up and down the beach, calling out Robin's name. She ran along the edge of the water, hoping for a glimpse of his little red bathing suit, hoping to see his face among the children who were dabbling near the shore. Then up and down the beach again, begging the bathers to tell her if they'd seen a little boy with blonde hair. It was hopeless, of course. There might have been dozens of children on the beach who answered to that description. And then, through sun-dazzled eyes, she saw it. A crowd gathered in the shade beneath the promenade. She burst into tears and began walking towards them, knowing what she would find. Robin had drowned, and the knot of people had gathered round to gawk. She had already begun to hate them. But as she drew closer, a wave of laughter went up, and she shoved her way through to the center of the crowd, not caring what they thought. It was a Punch and Judy show, and there, seated on the sand, tears of laughter running down his face, was her Robin. She grabbed him up and hugged him, not trusting herself to say a word. After all, it had been her fault. She had fallen asleep, and Robin had been attracted to the Punch and Judy pitch, as any child would be. She carried him along the beach and bought him an ice and another. Then she ran back with him to the little booth to watch the next performance, and she joined in when he roared with laughter, and she shouted out with him, "No, no!" when Punch grabbed the policeman's stick to beat Judy on the head. They laughed with the rest of the crowd when Punch tricked Jack Ketch, the hangman, into sticking his own head into the noose. And I had seen the traditional Punch and Judy shows nearly every year at the church fete, and I was all too familiar with the plot. "I don't know how to be hanged," I said, quoting Punch's famous words. "You'll have to show me, then I shall do it directly." "I don't know how to be hanged," Sally echoed. "You'll have to show me." That's what Grace told the jury later, when an inquest was called into Robin's death, and those were likely her last sane words. Worse than that was the fact that, at the inquest, she spoke those words in that awful, strangled, quacking voice that the puppet show men use for Punch. "I don't know how to be hanged. You'll have to show me." It was ghastly. The coroner called for a glass of water, and someone on the jury lost their nerve and laughed. Grace broke down completely. The doctor insisted that she be excused from further questioning. The rest of what happened that awful day at the beach and later at the farm had to be pieced together. Each of us knew a little. I had seen Robin dragging about a length of rope he'd found in the machine shed. Later, Gordon had seen him playing cowboy at the edge of Jubilee Field.
It was Dieter who found him hanging in Gibbet Wood.
Dieter? I thought it was Mad Meg. It slipped out before I could stop myself.
Sally looked instantly away, and I realized that it was one of those times when I needed to keep my mouth shut and wait things out. Suddenly, she seemed to come to a decision.
You must remember, she said, that we were only just out of the war. If it was known in Bishop's Lacey that Robin's body had been found hanging in the wood by a German prisoner of war, well, just think.
It might have been like that scene from Frankenstein, furious villagers with torches and so forth.
Exactly, she said. Besides, the police believed that Meg actually had been there before Dieter, but that she hadn't told anyone.
How do you know that? I asked. What the police believed, I mean.
Without realizing what she was doing, Sally was suddenly fluffing up her hair.
There was a certain young police constable,